Especially towards the end, I went very fast. I know. I spilled on you concepts that demand knowledge of statistical mechanics, advanced statistical mechanics, which again, I apologize for that, but I just wanted to kind of give a preview of where we're going because before we start superconductivity, I want these concepts actually to be better understood. So I'm not teaching the course on advanced statistical mechanics, but the most important concept I want to get out of the analysis of field theory is the concept of spontaneously broken symmetry. So it's a concept that people who don't study thermodynamic systems, in other words, infinite systems, will never understand. It's something that happens when you take the system to infinity. And the Heisenberg antiferromagnet exhibits spontaneously broken symmetry, the ferromagnet, and essentially lots of phases of matter at low temperature exhibit it. And even the vacuum of particle physics exhibits it. And the question is how to define it properly. In condensed matter, we have a very well-defined prescription of defining spontaneously broken symmetry. Essentially, what you calculate is a response of a system, a thermodynamic system, to some kind of a field that you apply to the system. So to make things concrete, let's imagine that we have a magnetic system, and I have in general a partition function which has a Hamiltonian that depends on operators like spins. And to that Hamiltonian, I add a magnetic field that couples, let's say, to the spin in the z direction on site I. I'm being very concrete here. It could couple to any other order parameter you like, but the idea is that this order parameter does not commute with Hamiltonian necessarily. Not necessarily equal to zero. This is sum over I. So we have some operator here. I just wrote here a spin in the z direction, which doesn't commute to Hamiltonian. I add a small source term, and now my partition function depends on this source term. And I could calculate by taking derivatives of the partition function, like I do in thermodynamics, I can calculate the magnetization. So magnetization, which is now a function of H, is defined as d log z dH. Actually, since I'm putting it multiplied by 1 over t, I multiply it by minus t. This magnetization as a function of H is given by the following limit, and that's very important. Limit of the size of the system to infinity, or the volume to infinity of okay, so that's the magnetization on a finite system. And so my infinite system magnetization is M thermodynamic is limit n goes to infinity or volume goes to infinity of m of h. And if I want to describe spontaneously broken symmetry, then limit of h goes to 0 plus of this object didn't leave space here. Limit of h goes to 0 plus of limit n goes to infinity of m of h is not equal to 0. So why is this order of limits very important? Because if I plot in a general system that wants to break symmetry. Just a second, I'll finish the explanation, I'll take questions. So this is my magnetic field H. As you put a magnetic field in the system, you polarize the spins. So my magnetization M will reach some asymptotic limit, which it can't be higher than the size of the spin, let's say. So I'm assuming it will reach some asymptotic limit and it'll start coming down. At a certain point, it'll go to zero when the magnetic field is zero, and then it will reverse sign when we reverse the magnetic field and reach asymptotic limit on the negative field direction. This is for a finite system. So any system which is finite, okay, that has a finite number of particles in it, cannot break symmetry spontaneously, especially when the operator doesn't commute with Hamiltonian. So if you take a bunch of atoms with spins and they interact, and you want to know what is the ground state. The ground state, unless there's some very strange degeneracies in the system, the ground state will be a superposition of the spins in all different directions. It's exactly like in quantum mechanics. If you have a double well and you ask, does the ground state break symmetry? No, the ground state is a symmetric combination of putting the atoms here and here. The breaking of symmetry, spontaneous breaking of symmetry, is when the system decides to sit on the left or on the right and sticks there, and quantum fluctuations are not important. In a sense, it's a process where all the wave functions get chopped down, the Hilbert space gets chopped down into one sector, and the other sector is completely invisible. So this process can never happen in a finite system. In a finite system, there's always tunneling and always restoration of symmetry, either by quantum or by thermal fluctuations. So often you ask yourself, how does a system break symmetry? Well, whenever you think about finite systems, it can never happen. When does it happen? It happens. That means that in any finite system, the magnetization, when you don't put an ordering field, should be zero. But you can see that a very weak ordering field immediately flips the system into where it would like to break symmetry. So what is this limit? This limit is looking at the curves going like this for larger and larger systems, and eventually for the infinite system, it'll reach some kind of a value here, not necessarily the saturation value, and this will be called the magnetization in the infinite system, the broken symmetry of the system, which is spontaneous, and that may or may not happen depending on the properties, the dimensionality, the Hamiltonian symmetries, the many other things, and one has to investigate this property. Classically, I can think of breaking symmetries much more easily than in quantum mechanics, because classically there's no tunneling, and you can think of getting stuck in a minimum without being able to get to the other side just by laws of classical mechanics. So when you cool a classical gas below some temperature, just all the atoms fall into some solid configuration and break symmetry of translation. It's not such a difficult concept to understand classically, even at finite temperature, but still, it's a delicate issue, the question is both asked at finite temperatures and at zero temperature. So it's a different question. It's the same question of whether there is a broken symmetry that survives at finite temperature or zero temperature, and these are exactly the questions that were answered in statistical mechanics using theorems that I'll describe soon. Yeah.
Hamiltonian when you added the SIZ term. Mm-hmm. So it looks like the small h denotes magnetic field, and we're assuming it's pointing in some direction, so I've already taken the dot product between magnetic field and magnetic moment, and the magnetic moment appears in the
yeah,
SIZ.
I put it in the Z direction.
Okay. that's a start. And then when you describe, so you drew that sketch of, it looks like, did you say it's a quantum ground state? What exactly did you show?
This is a double well.
Okay.
And that's the symmetric ground state. Doesn't break symmetry, right?
Okay. As in probability of finding a particle over here, over there, is equal. So what precisely does, how precisely does this double well ground state relate to our magnetic system?
This is an example of a finite Hamiltonian, only two minima, not infinite number of minima, right? It's a finite Hamiltonian, zero dimensional if you want, cannot break symmetry. If the potential, which is the Hamiltonian, has a symmetry, let's say, of reflection, this reflection symmetry survives, all the symmetries survive. You can label, all the theorems of quantum mechanics essentially say to that, right? Because you can label all the states in terms of even and odd parity. That means that both the even and odd parity don't break symmetry. The states themselves, under reflection, return to themselves. They don't return to other states. So they might give us a plus or minus quantum number, but they're not breaking any symmetry. So therefore, a finite system, no matter how complex it is, doesn't have this property of spontaneously broken symmetry. Yeah.
If any real system has finite number of particles, then, and if it never have spontaneously broken symmetry for such systems, then why do we see them in real systems?
Okay, I'll make one caveat, because you might find it in the literature, it's bad language, I think. There are systems whose ground state is degenerate. Let's say a ferromagnet. We didn't discuss the quantum ferromagnet, but the quantum ferromagnet, the Hamiltonian commutes with the magnetization. So you can label, there will be two S plus one ground states, and they all will be degenerate. And you can pick one of them. That's not spontaneously broken symmetry in my book. I mean, when you have degeneracy, which is a very, very delicate issue, you can lift it with tiny, tiny perturbations, right? Put in a small disorder, a small field term, and immediately the degeneracy gets lifted by degenerate perturbation theory. But if you have precise degeneracy, it's true that you can pick this ground state, which has a particular magnetization, let's say, spin up, and this is total spin down, and you can say, oh, I broke symmetry in a finite system, okay? But that's not the rules of the game here. I'm not assuming degeneracies and precise symmetries in the Hamiltonian, which are very easily thrown away by real perturbations. Yeah?
Now, in the graph that actually describes the magnet, even considering S that's approaching an infinite size.
Yes.
So I see that as.
This is n equal to n less than infinity. And this guy is n equal to infinity.
I see that as n increases, our lines are getting steeper. But how does, what precisely happens at n equals infinity? Why should?
These curves just asymptotically become a theta function.
Okay.
And there's a finite limit when you take h from the positive direction, and a different limit when you take it from the negative direction.
Okay.
So physically, what I'm thinking about is the system wants to break symmetry and become a magnet, but quantum mechanics doesn't allow it. So I put in a small polarizing field, and now there's no problem polarizing. And the question is order of limits. If you take the system to infinity before you take the ordering field to zero, you'll get a finite magnetization in the ground state. So in any finite system, the ground state might be completely symmetric. So if you look at the spectrum here, if I want to think about quantum mechanically, because here in the Perimeter Institute, quantum mechanics is an important subject. So I like to discuss eigenstates and eigenfunctions. What happens is, it's true that the ground state is spin, total spin, is equal to zero, which is a singlet rotational invariant under any transformation of spin. So it's completely symmetric. But the excited states, which are not spin 0, spin 1, spin 2, spin 300, are very close by. And this is in a finite system, n less than infinity. As I make the system larger, of course, all the eigenstates start coming down because the level spacing goes down. Eventually, they crash into the ground state and admix with it and form the broken symmetry state. The only way you can do it at a finite system is put in a small magnetic field. What does a magnetic field do? It doesn't move the singlets, but it pushes down the triplets and spin two and so on, and it mixes them with the ground state, and it causes level crossing, complete rearrangement of the spectrum, and eventually one has to describe the system not using these eigenstates, but using, let's say, spin wave theory. So going from the finite size quantum mechanics to the thermodynamic description is not a trivial process, okay? And one has to be careful when you talk about eigenstates in the thermodynamic limit. It's not really a well-defined concept. So spontaneously broken symmetry, I say, is a concept coming from classical mechanics, but extends to quantum mechanics. In classical mechanics, you also define it the same way. There you can define it at a finite temperature. And one can ask, which systems break symmetry, which systems don't break symmetry. So you know that a ferromagnet breaks symmetry, it chooses a particular direction, but if you heat it up above the Curie temperature, it's a paramagnet. And there's no magnetization. And there's actually a phase transition going on between ferro and para magnet, and that's the subject that you'll study in the course on statistical mechanics. I just appeal to your, let's say, intuition from common knowledge that this is what happens. Now, what I want to do is show you a sketchy proof of a theorem that talks about when symmetry breaking is allowed and when it's not allowed in a system with continuous symmetry. That's related to the Heisenberg model, but it's more general. And yes?
This might be what you're going to cover, but I think that you said right at the beginning of class that there are very precise ways of saying what a spontaneously broken symmetry is. We've just seen an example of spontaneously broken symmetry, and we've seen an example of unbroken symmetry. But what precisely is?
Okay, so you're right. I showed it only for this case. But this is generic. In other words, now, instead of course talking about SZ, talk about any operator that doesn't commute with Hamiltonian, so therefore it will not have the same symmetries as Hamiltonian. Right? When an operator doesn't commute, it means it doesn't have the same quantum numbers. And polarize that operator, so just replace this with any operator O, and this with any operator O, add a small field, measure the expectation value of O, and now measure the expectation value of O after you take the system to infinity and see if it's zero or not. So having it non-zero is going to break symmetry. Now, those O's are going to be, let's say, in a spin problem, it will be the magnetization, but not just necessarily the magnetization. For instance, think about the antiferromagnet. The magnetization doesn't break any symmetry. In the ground state, the magnetization is zero, right? Because you have up spins, down spin on two sublattices, sum is zero. But the staggered magnetization, which is sublattice A magnetization, that does break symmetry. It points in a particular direction out on the sphere. So you have to choose your other parameter. Not all of them will give you breaking symmetry, but it's enough to have one to claim that the ground state is already a broken symmetry state. Yes?
Polarize by adding a field?
A field polarizes the system, right? An electric field polarizes the electric medium, gives you a dipole moment. A magnetic field polarizes, a magnetic system gives you magnetization. That's called polarizing. You induce, essentially, this expectation value with a field. The question is, does the expectation value stay there when you take the field away? That's the spontaneous broken symmetry, okay?
And the expectation value in general is of the quantity that's the moment.
People call it the ordered moment. Yeah. That's another word that's saying. Yes?
So I'm used to seeing spontaneously broken symmetry in, for example, the particle physics context, where you have like a big field with some sort of a Mexican hat potential of some kind. So in that kind of a circumstance, you can draw the vacuum potential for the Higgs, and it has, you know, some very specific shape. So can you, in this kind of a system, draw something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's an example, particularly simple one from the statistical mechanics point of view, which actually I'll talk about it because it's part of the theorem I want to prove. That's called the ON model. And the Higgs, I guess it's instead of ON, it's SU2 plus U1. But
yeah,
it's some kind of a symmetry, not O3, but similar to O3, but it's some kind of a symmetry in the classical limit that is broken spontaneously by the vacuum. The mystery is, of course, we think always of the vacuum being empty. I think the biggest discovery this year of the Higgs was, you know, explained by particle physicists to the public as being a great feat of theoretical physics because it was predicted a long time ago. As a condensed matter physicist, I think what is much more exciting is it proves that the first proof, not circumstantial, but actual evidence that the vacuum is not empty. It's full of some matter, call it the Higgs field, that, like a ferromagnet, breaks symmetry. And the only evidence of the existence of this matter is the small oscillations of the amplitude of that matter, which are the particles that were discovered in CERN. So that's my take on it. It's not the numbers fit and the diagrams worked out and so on. It's that there's actually a different vacuum than what one would naively think. Naively, one would say vacuum is essentially an empty space with a little bit of positron electron virtual fluctuations. But the Higgs actually is a much more interesting aspect of the vacuum. But again, in condensed matter, all these concepts were developed in condensed matter. It's essentially just a part of the possible phases that one can get when you have fields with certain symmetries. So I'll describe now when symmetry is broken or not, and a lot of these questions might be answered. Yeah.
Yeah. Just before you do that, if the magnetization is an average or mean value of some of that size, shouldn't that derivative be with respect to age, with respect to the magnetic field applied, not temperature?
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry. Actually, yeah. So actually, to be a bit more explicit, this is going to be 1 over z trace. And here I'm going to put this operator, sum over I s z, e to the minus beta h. But I'm setting h here eventually. Well, here it's still as a function of h, but here I'm setting h to 0. So, well, I should write it h sum over I s z, but I'm setting h to 0 here. So this is the kind of calculation one does. If you look at this trace at any finite system, again, by symmetry, sz contributions will cancel the one with the minus sz contributions. This trace sums over all spin configurations, the pluses and the minus the same amount. This is odd. The weight is even, and therefore, when you take h to 0, the weight is even. And you can prove just by simple mathematics that any finite system will give you 0 in the limit h goes to 0 limit. But as I said, that's not true in the thermodynamic limit. So now we'll talk about that. But okay. So now I'm going to do a bit of statistical mechanics, but in a very simple. I mean, I'm not going to use difficult mathematics. I'm going to use Gaussian integrals, and that's all. So I want to think now about Hamiltonians. This is now a classical Hamiltonian, but it's written in terms of fields. Classical Hamiltonian H, which depends on some variables, psi, the following way, 1 over 2, integral d x dimension, and there is a derivative with respect to mu of psi as which has component alpha, and alpha runs from 1 to n. This is a Gaussian field theory, where what I wrote here is derivative with respect to space, and I have to write mu equal to 1 to d. So psi as a vector has psi 1, psi 2, up to psi n. So for the O(n) model, you have n components. For O(3), you have three components, x, y, z. And what I write here is essentially a combination of fields. Their derivative squared, that's essentially going to be the interaction. What does this interaction want to do? It wants to keep the psi constant. Actually, the lowest energy will be just setting psi equal to 0. But what I'm saying is, in this particular simple Hamiltonian, I can evaluate correlations. So, for instance, if I want to study psi of x prime, correlation function. This is now a two-point correlation function that I want to evaluate with this Hamiltonian. So how do I do it? It's 1 over the partition function, integral d psi, e to the minus h of psi divided by t. That's trace. This is trace, summing over all the degrees of freedom. They depend on x. This is the Hamiltonian. That's the temperature. This is the partition function. And now I'm evaluating psi of x prime. Question is, how do I do this integral? Well, this is a Gaussian integral, essentially, because the weight is just a Gaussian. It has these derivatives. So the best way to do it is, of course, Fourier transform. I can essentially look at a different correlator, which is written in terms of Fourier components. So if I look at the the correlator 1 over v integral dx prime psi x prime, this correlator could be written in terms of Q space as 1 over v integral dx prime. I'm ignoring here the dimensionality, but yeah, there's dimensionality d. I have here psi of q prime, sum over q and q prime, which is the Fourier transform. And then I have the exponents iqx plus q prime x prime. And this is an expectation value I need to take. So by just adding and subtracting minus x here plus, q minus, qx minus x prime. Okay, so I'll write it separately. So q prime x prime, I'm writing this as qx minus x prime plus q prime plus q x prime. Right? I didn't do anything bad. Just replace this by this. Now notice the following. There's an integral dx prime. And here there's an I q plus q prime. And there's nothing else integrating with x prime. So that gives me a delta function of q is equal to minus q prime. So in this double sum, I'm left with 1 sum over q. So I have a 1 sum over q, e to the I q x minus x prime. And then I have phi of q, phi of minus q, expectation value. So here I already proved the system has translational symmetry because it depends on x minus x prime only. And now all I need to do is calculate this guy. Now this guy to calculate is much easier because the Hamiltonian is not diagonal in x space. It has derivatives in x space. But in q space, it's diagonal. So I just need to replace this by half, sum over q. And a derivative in q space becomes just multiplying by q. and then a psi q absolute value squared. I have a psi q, psi minus q, but this is a real field, so the Fourier transform is, and there's a sum over alpha, and this is now q squared, and there's a sum over alpha from 1 to n. And that's the action. It's very simple. That's the Hamiltonian written in Q space. So in Q space, you see all these Gaussian integrals are completely separated. Every Q has its own Gaussian integral in this expression. So if I want to calculate this correlation, it's better first to calculate psi of q. Okay, so what is psi of q? Psi of minus q. 1 over z.
Correlation function that's right below the Hamiltonian. And then, it looks like the line below that is used in order to calculate the correlation function
above.
Why does that result from what correlation function equals? Why does that give us an expression for the Hamiltonian?
No, the Hamiltonian, I just did a Fourier transform of this expression or of this expression.
Okay. You said when we were dealing with the correlation function that this depends just on the difference x minus x prime and shows that our system is translationally invariant.
Yeah.
You say that the correlation function is translationally invariant. How do I infer from that that the whole system is in Hamiltonian?
Actually, by looking at Hamiltonian, you see immediately that if it's on an infinite size lattice, yeah, I'm now assuming the lattice is infinite, or the lattice could be a torus. Doesn't matter. It has to have periodic boundary condition or infinite. Then if you move x to x prime, right, the derivative doesn't depend on, the derivative operation doesn't change. It becomes essentially the same. I can do a shift of variables, x goes to x prime, and this will be completely the same. So this is translational invariant Hamiltonian. It doesn't have any particular point in space that's special. That's called translational invariant. So since it has any point in space, if I measure the correlation from x to x prime, it's the same as x plus a to x prime plus a. And therefore, the Fourier transform has only one momentum, q and minus q. And when I calculate now in q space, psi of q, psi of minus q, and I have here psi of q, this is prime, this is the correlation I want to calculate, e to the minus t, 1 over 2t sum over q, q squared psi alpha squared, the sum of alpha. So this is also, so this is actually q prime, alpha prime. This is a sum over all the q's and alphas. Here is a particular q that I'm interested in. So if I want to evaluate this, it's just a Gaussian integral because all these momenta q prime will separate. So how do you calculate this correlation function? It's quite easy. You could do it. The trick I like to do is, again, add a source term, take derivative. That's the best way to do Gaussian integrals. So imagine that I added here small h of q. Now my function z, okay, so I can write this, you can convince yourself that this is equal to minus t d dh q of z, which is a functional of hq, log of that. Then we'll see why. So if I take log of z is just this integral, take the log of it, take the derivative with respect to hq, what will happen? It will take down the psi of q and psi of q squared, exactly this object that I need, multiplied by, it's actually 2t, so I need to multiply that by 1 over 2t, 2t, like that. So I take this derivative, I will get this function. If I get this function, And then because it's a log, I get 1 over z. So that's essentially what I need to do. Now, since this is just a product, the z of q, z is just a product over q of d psi squared, it's actually d squared psi of q, e to the minus 1 over 2t psi of q squared. This is just a Gaussian integral with q squared here. This is just Gaussian integrals, product of Gaussian integrals. Each one of them is equal by Gaussian integration to 2 pi divided by times actually pi. It's 2 pi t divided by q squared. That's all it is. Okay? Just simple Gaussian integrals, you know how to do, for a complex variable psi running from minus infinity to infinity. It, since it's complex, you have a real and imaginary part continuing the square root of 2 pi t over q squared. So twice it'll give you the linear function. So this is z in general. All I have to do when I have z of h is essentially put here an h of q. So z of h has h of q here in the denominator. That adds to this. And now what I need is to take the log derivative of z of h of q with respect to h of q and set h q to 0 after I took the derivative. So taking the log derivative of this guy will give me, okay, these constants don't, well, they matter for when I take the derivative with respect to h, I'll get essentially, when I take the log of this, I get 1 over h plus q squared. So take the derivative, I'll get 1 over q squared. And I need to multiply by 2t, so 2t. Very simple. So you see that psi of q, psi of minus q, is simply twice the temperature divided by q squared. Yes?
You calculate the transform entropy between the psi q and psi minus q.
Right.
But when you do the derivation of hq, then you get a psi q prime square. It would be the same q.
No, this is q prime. Sorry, this is q prime. This is summed over.
Yeah.
This is summed over. And this is a particular q.
Yeah.
That's the particular q here.
I mean, when you do the partial q,
yeah.
Actually you get is a psi q square, right?
Yeah, this is psi q squared, yeah.
But what you want to get for the left is psi q, psi minus.
It's the same.
Yeah.
This is equal
this
to...
This should be the different.
It's the same. Because psi minus q is psi q star, right? It's a Fourier transform of a real field.
Oh.
Yes?
Okay, I have some questions. So in the expression down there, there's a sum over q, e to the iq, where you show the transaction invariant.
Yeah.
Down. What is in the exponential? Is that x minus x prime? Because that doesn't make any sense.
Well, because the original.
Because you integrated over x prime.
No, I just integrated over x prime. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. That was q. Just a second.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a mess up here. I know what I did. Okay. Okay, this guy here is equal to psi of x minus x prime, psi of 0, by translational symmetry. And I can now fictitiously add any. Yeah, so what I show here is I can average this over, I can translate this by any. Okay.
It's just at the end you have two different axes.
No, I wanted to shift variables, that's it.
And you started with two different axes and integrated over one of them. You can't have two.
Yeah, this condition here came from the symmetry that I can integrate over x prime without changing the result. Okay, and I do a shift of, let's see. Okay. Maybe the way to do it is the following. I have a variable y here. And here I have y plus, that's the trick. Here I have y plus x prime and x prime. Psi of x prime. Now, when I take this expression, which is exactly the same because I'm averaging over all the x prime and the translation invariant, then now I have y here. And here I have
without prime.
Without y, prime, right? And here I have x prime, and I change it to, this is again, q times y is what I want to be left with. And then I have q prime x prime minus. Okay, so there's q times y plus x prime. Yeah, now it's good. Y plus x prime in this case, plus q prime x prime. Fine. Now I have this q plus q prime x prime, and I'm integrating over x prime to give q minus q, and I'm left with q y. So I essentially ended up with a function of y, which is the difference of x and x prime, and I had the delta function of q minus q. Okay, so I cleaned it up a bit better. So what essentially I show here is that this is the object I need to calculate, psi of q, psi of minus q, to get the real space correlation between y.
So did you start with correlation of between y and zero?
Yes.
Okay, and second question. When you're doing the differentiation with respect to hq,
yes.
As you know, it seems like you still get, you don't get just the term psi alpha q psi alpha minus q, but you get the sum over.
Okay, so now I take the derivative with respect to a particular q, the same q as this.
Yeah, and then.
And I'm setting all the hq to zero after.
Sure, but shouldn't you call the, because over there you call it hq prime, it should be like hq alpha. Because you want to select only one alpha and one q.
Ah, yes. The
you still have the sums.
Right, I'm sorry, I should put an alpha on the h, because I'm polarizing
in
particular. And then I have an alpha index here, you're right.
Yes.
And
then there's no prime in the top right corner. There's no prime on the h u.
No, this guy?
No, above. Yeah, but in
the... Well, all the h's I'm setting to zero. After
I know, but in the top right corner, yes.
This guy?
Top right, to the right, yes. Yeah, and that's not right. At HQ prime.
No, I want it to be polarizing a particular alpha. I want to calculate this particular alpha. So I'm putting a field relative to every single field, both in Q and alpha, is separate.
Okay.
These fields all, again, have indices alpha. And I'm taking derivative respect to the field polarizing alpha to get the psi alpha, Q minus Q correlator, which is this. That's all. Okay, so now I can use this to evaluate this. That's the main point I want to say. So when I have psi of q minus psi of q is 1 over t over q squared, I can evaluate, for instance, the equal space that psi 0, again, I used it for any field, you can add index alpha, and that's what I want to get at. So now I want to calculate. So this is something we did already. And now I want to calculate what will happen in a model which has spontaneous symmetry breaking. So let's look at Hamiltonian that is given by d dx d mu psi alpha squared, sum over mu and alpha, plus, and now we write down a Mexican hat potential, which is the kind you see in the Higgs theory. It's essentially psi vector squared minus some m squared, all this squared, and maybe I'll make it simple by writing here 1 over 8. Now, if you look at this model, it's got very few parameters in here. I can scale fields and scale distances and make this always look like that when I start with some field theory with more coupling constants. But once I write this Hamiltonian, I want to understand what it says. If I look at this part, and let's say I take psi to be two-dimensional. Let's say psi is O2. So it's psi 1, psi 2. So in the space psi 1, psi 2, there's a Mexican hat potential. You want to write it this way. I'm an expert in drawing these things. I'm very proud. Kind of a bowl where it has a minimum, that's this vacuum value it's called, where the order parameter would like to minimize the energy of this potential. This is a system that may or may not break symmetry depending on temperature, because it has this gradient fluctuation terms, which is finite. It means that thermal fluctuations can add a lot of configurations where the fields are circulating around, restoring symmetry. Yes?
Do you mind explaining which lines represent what represents energy, what represents size?
This is the potential. This is V, or this is actually this function in two dimensions. You take vectors in two dimensions, x and y, psi x, psi, you want to call it x and y. So you see that when the magnitude is equal to m, this is m. That's the radius of this potential. This is zero. Everywhere else, it's finite. So you can identify that this is a potential that has this kind of a vacuum valley. Important thing about this vacuum valley, it has a degenerate ground state. There's a symmetry in this problem, which is O2. I can rotate my Hamiltonian, and the potential stays the same, and the gradient terms stay the same. So this is an O2 modulo, has a rotational symmetry of O2. And you can imagine the same thing in three dimensions, four, to be O3, O4, O5, ON. It's the same idea. OK, so now one can say, well, if this is the potential, the symmetry should be broken. And then one has to do a calculation and see if that's self-consistently correct. I just give you the result, and then I'll show you an argument for why this result is right. There is a theorem by Merman and Wagner, which in my book, I show the rigorous theorem. The rigorous theorem is for quantum and classical. Classical is just the limit of quantum models. So the theorem is proven for classical models using magnetic Hamiltonians, but it's much more general than that. And it says the following. If you have n larger than 1, which is symmetry, which is continuous, right? For symmetry, n equal 1, there's no symmetry. There's just a double well problem. With no, well, there's a reflection symmetry, but it's not continuous. N larger than 1, then n equal to 2 is called the XY model. n equal 3 is the Heisenberg that we're talking about. And then 4, 5, 6 are other models. But for n equal larger than 1, in dimension d equal 1 and 2 at finite temperature, t larger than 0, no spontaneously broken symmetry allowed. That was actually a surprise theorem when it was proven. It went in the face of mean field theory. I'm not telling you what mean field theory is now. You'll study it. But mean field theory is wrong. It does predict broken symmetry. And the theorem does not allow it in dimension 1 and 2 at any finite temperature. Yes?
We're saying there are no spontaneously broken symmetries, but and the restrictions on the theorem are number of particles and number of dimensions. This is for absolutely any Hamiltonian that satisfies that number of particles and number of dimensions.
The theorem is for any Hamiltonian with continuous symmetry. If you want the full conditions, it has to have continuous symmetry like this Hamiltonian. It has to have short-range interactions, which here the interactions are local completely, right? Interaction is exactly at point x. You have psi to the fourth acting on one point x. You could also imagine Hamiltonians where psi of x is interacting with psi of x prime, not at the same space. That still is allowed as long as the distance between x and x prime is short enough or finite. That's called the short-range interaction model. And that's it. Now, the theorem is much stronger than what I'm going to show for field theory because it applies to lattice Hamiltonians, which are much more complicated, with operators that you can, you know, very complicated ones you can write down. It doesn't matter. All that's necessary is that there is the symmetry and that you're at low enough dimensions. So this is actually a surprise because you take a ferromagnet in one dimension. All the spins want to point in the same direction. And then you add a tiny bit of temperature larger than zero. And this order gets messed up. And there's no broken symmetry. If I take the field away, the symmetry is restored, and there's no magnetization. You take the same thing in two dimensions, and it's still true. In two dimensions, again, no broken symmetry at any finite temperature. And the reason comes from the fact that you have a spontaneously broken continuous symmetry. It's this vacuum valley that causes this problem. Since the zero temperature is very low, low temperature is very low energies, but moving along this vacuum valley costs you no energy because it's a completely degenerate manifold. You can see why at low temperatures the system would start distorting and, if you want, thermally occupying all these different directions and messing up the spin order.
That we've covered most recently put together. We started with that classical Hamiltonian, and then it looks like we specialized to this particular case.
No, we didn't specialize.
We added a term.
We used the same Hamiltonian. This is the same Hamiltonian, but I added now a symmetry breaking term. We discussed just the Gaussian term for purposes I'm going to use now, but then I'm adding some kind of a term that wants to show you that the system wants to break continuous symmetry. See, this Hamiltonian itself is no symmetry breaking here because there's no Mexican hat potential. It's just a Gaussian and average psi is zero. Here, average psi wants to be sitting here in this bottom of the hat. And that is the mechanism that would lead to simultaneous symmetry breaking if it can. But the interesting thing is that it cannot, and was a surprise, I said, because I guess intuition says that if you have strong enough interactions, then at low enough temperatures, you'll get a broken symmetry state. And this Mermin-Wagner theorem actually is now possible to extend to quantum cases after I understand the theorem itself, because of this mapping we did last class between the quantum Heisenberg model in D dimensions to the classical Heisenberg model in D plus one. So now that we're talking about classical models, we'll be able to know something about quantum models as well. Yes?
And so if we back up two steps from the theorem and looking at it, just that classical Hamiltonian that has no spontaneously broken symmetry, we calculated the correlation function. But did we say explicitly why we were calculating this correlation function?
No, not yet. Now I'm going to use it.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to use this this result I found there to prove this theorem. I'm not going to prove this theorem for you, because as I said, it's a rigorous theorem that needs to use powerful methods. But I'm going to show you the arguments that are used by field theorists, actually, which is not rigorous, to argue that symmetry cannot be broken, at least not self-consistently, because the fluctuations that you get when you include finite temperature fluctuation, thermal fluctuations, destroy whatever order you assumed is happening. Yes?
Would you mind explaining this
This is a 5/4 Mexican hat potential. More vector notations. V of x is equal to x squared minus m squared squared. That is the shape of the potential, if the letter psi is confusing to you. Because it's just the local, at a particular point, that's what the field would like to do. Okay? Yes?
Okay, so just to make sure I understand this kind of schematically, we're saying that no matter how low we bring the temperature, we cannot reuse the system into one particular
Precisely.
Point in that valley. It
yes.
sort of circulates around them.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that is the surprise. The Mellman-Wagner theorem, as I said.
Yeah, that's really counterintuitive to me. But
it's
okay.
Counterintuitive. It went against a lot of statistical mechanics thoughts that went on at the time. And in fact, it's one of the great mathematical physics, I think, contributions that put boundaries on approximations. And every time you find an approximation that violates the theorem, you have to ask why, and you find interesting physics from that. Yeah.
So when you are saying mass state is rotation invariant, you indicate that is. So what is the relation between rotation and the symmetry?
Well, if you look at the path integral or the partition function, it has complete symmetry, right? The question is, if you put in a small field, let's say in the x direction, that symmetry will be broken. And then if you take the field to zero, will it stay broken? That's the question of spontaneously broken symmetry. Right? The partition function at zero field is symmetric. But can it be easily polarized to be finite magnetization? That's the spontaneous broken symmetry. So we now are in a position to try to prove this. To argue for this theorem. And what we do is essentially an expansion. It will look very similar to spin wave expansions, except it's easier because it's just space and no time here. So let's assume that psi wants to break symmetry. So let's assume that psi is equal to m 0, 0, where this is the components 1, 2, 3 to n. And this is my assumption. So what does it mean to assume it? Let me say that there is a staggered magnetization, which is the size m, sitting in the x direction, exactly like this. Psi 0. And it's a vector, which is now m times x hat. And my path integral is going to be summing over all the fluctuations about that limit. I'm expanding the path integral around this point. So I can write psi in general without the expectation value in my path integral as m plus sigma of x. And then in the other direction, I'll call it pi. That's the usual description of longitudinal and transverse fluctuations. This is of size n minus 1. Just a parameterization. So let me draw the circle. I have my order parameter psi here, and then I have sigma in this direction, pi in this direction. So all I need to do is plug into this expression, this expansion. So what do I get? I get that the Hamiltonian now is going to look like integral d dx. D mu. Okay, when I take a derivative with respect to field, this is a constant, so I'll just get d mu sigma squared plus d mu pi squared. That's the kinetic terms. And then I get plus, and let me expand the psi to the fourth. So psi to the fourth is going to be 1 over 8, and then inside here I have m plus sigma squared plus pi squared, that's psi squared, right? Minus m squared, everything squared. So let me expand this. This is m squared plus 2m sigma plus sigma squared, and then there's a pi squared, minus m squared. So m squared cancels m squared, and from this whole business, I'll get 2 squared. Ah, I forgot the half here. Always need it. Okay, 2 times this guy, it's 4 m squared sigma squared divided by 8. So I get a half m squared sigma squared. And then I get some interaction terms. I'll get plus 2m sigma plus sigma squared plus pi squared, so 2m sigma squared plus pi squared, all that squared. So, no, sorry, the 2m sigma I took into account, so I'll get just the cross terms, just a second. Let me write it explicitly. All these terms are not going to be important, but I'm going to have 2m sigma cube times 4m sigma cube. Then I get sigma to the fourth, pi to the fourth, and then sigma pi squared. In other words, things which are cubic, quartic, higher order in both sigma and pi, so small. What I want to do now is concentrate on what I have left. What I have left is essentially a quadratic action. I know how to treat quadratic Hamiltonians. And so I'm writing this approximately as d dx. An action for the sigma, d mu sigma squared plus, there's a half m squared sigma squared, plus d mu pi alpha squared, alpha runs from 2 to n. This is my spin wave, and there's sigma pi to the power 3. That's the result. Yes?
Psi has this particular form, m, and just zeros after it. Then we wrote psi of x. How come that has something other than just m?
No, psi fluctuates both in the direction x, which is sigma, and transverse, which is pi. And now I'm expanding to small sigma and pi to get a quadratic action in terms of sigma and pi.
Oh, it's the expectation value as opposed to...
I'm expanding about the expectation value. That's the idea of broken symmetry calculation. It's exactly like what we did for the path integral when you assume that omega was in the direction of x, and we looked at small delta theta delta phi. It's the same idea, and what we get out of it is a harmonic action. It's quadratic. Notice the difference between the sigma and the pi. The sigma has a mass. It has essentially a force constant multiplying sigma squared. But the pi's don't. The pi is exactly the Gaussian theory we had before. It has no mass term. The energy here, if you go to Q space, just goes like Q squared. This goes like Q squared, pi Q squared. So when Q goes to zero, the coefficient here goes to zero, and this is a very soft mode. These are the Goldstone modes that exist in all these field theories when you break symmetry. It doesn't exist when you didn't break symmetry because the original model was an interacting model of psi to the fourth and not necessarily has any low energy modes. But once you break symmetry, you get these low energy modes, which are called Goldstone modes. And you also have a massive mode, and this is an amplitude mode, which is in the Higgs problem, it's the Higgs particle. Okay? It's just the amplitude mode. It has a mass. This is the Higgs mass, 140 GV, was found recently at CERN. But that's all it is, just amplitude mode, Goldstone mode. Now, where is the danger for a long-range order coming from? The danger comes from here, because these are soft. All this is multiplied by 1 over temperature. So even when temperature is very, very small, this at low Q is even smaller than temperature. So you can populate pi. Now, what I'm going to do is a very simple calculation of what is the order parameter in the presence of finite temperature, including the fluctuations. So I want to look at the order parameter fluctuations, and that's going to be the proof. Low stiffness. When you have a e to the minus a x squared in the Gaussian, when a is small, that's called soft. Okay, when you have a something that looks like a zero mode. So what I want to calculate now is psi squared minus m squared expectation value, which is equal to sigma squared plus pi squared of x. And what I'm interested mostly is in pi squared at the position x. Now, what is that going to be? Well, this is the Fourier transform, so it's a sum over q of pi q squared expectation value, right? Because it's translation invariant, so I can do a sum over q and divide by the volume. And now this guy, I will use the result I had before. So I have a sum over q. And each one of these q's is simply going to be 2t divided by q squared. Now I have to do this integral from q equal to 0, or let's say lower cutoff lambda, to some higher cutoff, let's call it q brilliant zone. The danger doesn't come from here. It comes from the low end. So in d equal to 1, I have an integral dq over 2 pi, 2t divided by q squared. That diverges like the lower cutoff 1 over lambda, t over lambda. So for any finite temperature, if I take lambda to 0, this goes to infinity when lambda goes to 0. That's called an IR divergence that essentially signals the fact that the fluctuations diverge. If the fluctuations diverge, the order parameter is going to be very different than m, essentially larger than the size of m. So that means that it fluctuates all over the Mexican hat potential. There's no broken symmetry. Now, I'm a bit pulling wool over your eyes by this proof, because I'm not proving there's no broken symmetry. I'm just proving that the assumption of starting with a finite m leads to an inconsistency. When you actually look at the proof, the rigorous proof of Mervyn and Wagner in my book, you can relate this statement to the actual proof. The actual proof also depends on the fact that there's a divergence of this kind of 1 over q squared that you have to integrate over, and it diverges and it violates an inequality, Bogoliubov inequality. I should mention actually that the first guy who proved the theorem was Hohenberg in the context of superfluidity, okay, which is a subject we're going to get to. And in that context, he proved the theorem has there's no superfluid order, which is kind of an exotic thing to think about. And then Merman and Wagner proved it for all magnetic ferromagnets, antiferromagnets, and so on in condensed matter. Yes?
I have several questions. Earlier we saw that the magnetization, its expectation value indicates that the symmetry is spontaneously broken.
Right.
At some point you started using the term order parameter.
Yeah.
Is that a generalization of the magnetization, as in it's anything?
Okay. Okay, this proof here, I'm not using a small field taking it to zero, but I could do the same. I mean, what essentially I'm doing is calculating the local order parameter fluctuations.
What is the order parameter?
Psi.
No, what is it?
Field. Okay. This field, psi, another word for it is local order parameter. It's the same. Local order parameter is a field psi. Averaged order parameter, which is the thermodynamic order parameter, is when you take an expectation value, you sum over all x, or if it's translational symmetric, it's enough to look at one point. So I'm using interchangeably the field and its expectation value. That's commonly done. So depending on the context of my sentence, sometimes when I say order parameter, I mean a field, and sometimes I mean its expectation value.
I'm wondering what in general is an order parameter? So you said that an order parameter is a field, but there are also
Okay. I'm sorry about this. It's a very common, ambiguity in notations. But when people write a field like this, it's sometimes called a field because it's a continuous function, a continuous vector field. And it's sometimes more in the physical context, let's say when you talk about some physical system, it's called a local order parameter. Now, local order parameter doesn't mean that there's broken symmetry. It's only when psi averaged over all configurations is non-zero, then you have what's called a broken symmetry. And a global order parameter. Okay, so this is the two times I'm using order parameters for different things. So the field itself is, I call it order parameter because that's the way it's usually referred to. If it's local, it's the field. And if I'm looking at expectation value, that's the quantity that I want to evaluate. This is the thing I'm evaluating here, the global order parameter. And the global order parameter depends on the fluctuations of the global order parameter, and that has to be summed over all q of the expectation value of the Goldstone modes squared. Those diverge, and therefore the fluctuations in the order parameter diverge in one dimension and also in two dimensions. D squared q over 2 pi squared, 2 pi over 2t over q squared, diverge like log t log lambda. Notice the value of t here. T is very important because if t was zero, I wouldn't be able to say anything. Indeed, Merman-Wagner theorem has nothing to say about temperature zero, because if you take this to zero, nothing diverges. But the finite temperature, you see, it's enough to have here microkelvin, and already you get the divergence. So for zero temperature, we have to go to a quantum model. And that's the purpose of the mapping we did last lesson. We actually found a way to use this theorem also for quantum models in one dimension lower. Yep?
Looks like global order parameter is one way to see that as symmetry spontaneously broken. Again, earlier in the class, we used magnetization to see that a symmetry is spontaneously broken.
Right.
But
So the proof does not cover rigorously the statement I made in the beginning. The proof just shows an indication that it's not a proof. The calculation I did here just shows that I suspect there cannot be an order parameter in one and two dimensions. Okay? In the senses that I discussed before, that if I put a small field and I'll take it to zero, the magnetization will vanish. So rigorously, you have to stick to the definition before. This is a non-rigorous argument in favor of the Mermin-Wagner theorem. But as I said, the Mermin-Wagner theorem really proves directly this relation, that M of H goes to zero, goes to zero. That's all. Okay, so what I did up there is what is proven by Mermin-Wagner theorem. This argument is close to the theorem. I mean, since the theorem is correct, then an argument that shows it should also be correct, right? Yes.
Sorry, maybe it's an obvious question. Do you say that if the order parameter blow up, then it indicates that no singular variance?
Okay, so I draw pictures, okay? Because again, I'm not doing a rigorous proof here. So the picture is the following. I have a double well. I have some temperature, that's an energy scale, right? I have an order parameter. Because the temperature allows configurations which include also some gradients, some long wavelength fluctuations. If I find that the average, if this is psi average, is the fluctuation, sorry, if I find that delta psi squared is larger than this distance, or twice this distance, or infinity, in fact, then it means that if I want to draw the fluctuations, they're much wider than the difference between the order parameter and minus the order parameter. All these have to be included, and therefore one suspects that symmetry is restored. This argument actually is quite common in condensed matter systems. For instance, one can ask, at what temperature does a solid melt? So how do you calculate such a thing? Assume there is a solid. Of course, there isn't. There's a liquid. But you assume there is a solid. Then you say, fine. Now I know the force constants. The force constants are some omega of k. Now I put some finite temperature. And now I ask, within this temperature, what is the displacement of the atoms that is consistent with the frequency omega k? And you find that the displacements of the atoms is much larger than the lattice constant A, then you say the solid must melt. That's called the Lindemann criteria. For melting. And it's most commonly used, and it's actually quite a good approach to know when what temperature a solid melts. It gives you that when delta U, delta X, I squared, much larger than lattice constant at function T, then it's a liquid. If it's not a liquid, it's a different solid. But that's how you guess when ice melts or something like that. You do exactly these kind of arguments, and you get ballpark figure, you know, 0 degree plus minus 50, I don't know. So, yes?
Why should the value of the average fluctuations indicate whether symmetry is broken or not? What does average fluctuations have to do with symmetry?
As I said, if I assume broken symmetry and the average fluctuations are bigger than my broken symmetry, then that's a relation, right? Broken symmetry is some kind of a choosing parts of Hilbert space. But if my fluctuations bring me to the other part, this part that's kind of out of bounds in the broken symmetry space, then I can't assume broken symmetry. These are, I say, not satisfying, but very useful ways of thinking about this. Of course, much better to have a rigorous mathematical proof. And fortunately, there is one for this particular problem. So I think, I think I discussed it quite thoroughly. Yes?
Context of
a theory of some physical system. I'm not sure exactly what it means to have the fluctuations in the local order parameter going to infinity when, like, there has to be some sort of, like, as you draw it in that diagram, like an infinitely tall wall.
Yes,
sort
yes.
of at some point, but then if it's going to infinity, it means you could be like out in Andromeda past the wall.
So if you wanted the full theory, you need to include all the interactions that go away. The cubic terms, right?
So
I said they're small.
So those constrain
the, of course, yes.
The
other parameter
can't
be going to infinity.
Right. Okay.
It can only be the size of its maximum value, or essentially of order m. The divergence I get in this low-order harmonic theory only signals that I could not throw away the cubic terms and higher. Since I don't know how to treat them, this method actually breaks down. This actually is very common. When things break down in physics, they break down big time. Okay? You can't push the theory any further. You have to use a different approach. And there are approaches for understanding this phase transition. For instance, one approach is you increase the number of components, n, and you do an expansion called large n, and then you have a theory for spins with very high degeneracy. And that actually is very easy to work out, large n expansions. And you get some idea of how the symmetry breaking works and what kind of correlation functions you should expect. But to actually solve the problem close to the critical point, or in this case, in one and two dimensions at finite temperatures, you could use numerics, okay, to get correlation functions. So now let's go back to what we said last, and I hope what I said in the last class will be more clear now, about the nonlinear sigma model. The nonlinear sigma model is just an ON model. It belongs to the class of models here. So we found that the quantum Heisenberg model, antiferromagnet, in d equal 1, looked like an integral d 2. Oh, okay, so yeah, d2x d mu n squared. This is definitely a model with three components with essentially a gradient term, and it satisfies the Merman-Wagner criteria. So therefore, it has no long-range order when you take the system, even if you take the system to infinity. Because this is equivalent, this was actually 1 over 2f, this was equivalent to a two-dimensional, d equal 2, classical model at temperature T equal to 1 over f. So any finite f, which is any finite size spin, is a finite temperature in the two-dimensional model, and a two-dimensional model is this order. In d equal 1, d equal 2, okay, finite temperature, that means finite beta less than infinity. What we have is essentially dx0, which is the temperature part, the imaginary time, dx, sorry, this is d equal 1, sorry. No, d equal 2. Yes. D squared x, d mu n squared. So this is the quantum Heisenberg model, two dimensions, and finite temperature. It maps to the nonlinear sigma model in 2 plus 1 dimension. But the 1 dimension is 0 to beta. It's not 0 to infinity, because we have a finite temperature. So what does this mean? This means it's a slab. It's a slab of finite thickness. A slab of finite thickness beta, actually, if I want in scales of distance x, it's beta divided by c, in my velocity, this is still a 2D system. So even if I take this Lx and Ly to infinity, I'm still in a 2D system. A 2D system, by Moermann-Wagner theorem, has no Lagrange order at finite temperature. There's a finite temperature here, 1 over f, still no long-range order. So the quantum Heisenberg model in two dimensions at finite temperature still has no long-range order, which is the same as the classical model in two dimensions. Classical Heisenberg model in d equal 2. So finite temperature immediately reduces the dimensionality from d plus 1 to d because it's a finite slab. However, one can ask what happens in the limit d equal 2, beta equal infinity. The quantum Heisenberg model maps to now really a three-dimensional d mu n squared, 1 of f. So it maps to a three-dimensional ferromagnet with temperature f at t equal to f. What does that, I'm ignoring here, I'm putting into f the cutoff part, which is important here. But once you do that, there's some temperature defined. Okay, what happens to the ferromagnet in three dimensions? Again, subject you'll study. It's quite well described, even though not accurately in the critical point. It's described by mean field theory. There is a phase transition. In three dimensions, there's a TC. Above TC, you have a paramagnet. Below TC, you have a ferromagnet. That's exactly like your magnet that you stick on the fridge. If you heat them above the Curie temperature, they won't stick anymore. If you cool them, they'll stick. Okay? Here, the spins have some average direction, and here, disordered. And this holds for actually nearly all statistical mechanics models, including Ising model, IXY, Heisenberg, Bots model. All these models have a phase transition in three dimensions called TC. What does a phase transition in three dimensions have to do with the quantum Heisenberg model? It has to do with the fact that now I can draw a zero temperature, because right, we're referring to zero temperature here, phase diagram. And there is some F, the temperature scale is F. There's some FC. If I'm below FC, I have an ordered phase. And if I'm above FC, I have a disordered. But this ordered phase is, in a sense, a interesting thing at zero temperature. It's what you call the quantum liquid. It's something that doesn't break symmetries even at zero temperature. There's very few systems that are suspected of behaving like that. So having a quantum liquid at zero temperature in three dimensions, in two dimensions even, and of course in three, is a rarity. But notice that I've drawn here a phase diagram where there's a point where the order goes away. And this point now is an interesting point by itself because it's a phase transition at zero temperature. When you learn in statistical mechanics phase transition, you will mostly describe, I think only describe, finite temperature phase transitions, like liquid to gas, or ferromagnet to paramagnet, or solid to liquid. But here, there's a zero temperature phase transition driven completely by quantum fluctuations, and it has the name quantum critical point. And it's a subject of a lot of current investigations, including a book by Subir Sachdev. Spends a lot of time discussing quantum critical points in certain models. They're particularly interesting because their excitations and correlations are very strange. They could be very strange, and they essentially properties of interesting quantum Hamiltonians. The understanding of what happens at the critical point, new particles emerge there, deconfined criticality, stuff like that. So as you can see, the quantum Heisenberg model is expected to have a quantum critical point. Unfortunately, as a function of parameter f, that is not so much under our tuning possibilities. I told you that f is essentially the size of the spin. Now, we can't play with the size of the spin. You're given spin a half or spin one, and that's it. But it also depends on these parameters, stiffness, compressibility. That depends on coordinations, on next nearest neighbor interactions, lattice structure, and so on. So people think they can play with this number and go through the quantum phase transition. In fact, they manage to do that in certain magnetic systems. But as I said, it's not as easy to control as temperature. It's a parameter. Okay, so I think by this I... Okay, so just a second. Yeah, I think I covered what I wanted to say. Any questions just for you? Okay, so see you tomorrow. Thank you.